Well, tobacco was America's first cash crop, and in fact, was the object of trade long before there was an America. But today, tobacco is seen as the scourge of millions, which leads us to ask, what do tobacco companies put in cigarettes?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 714th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, after touching land for the first time on an island in the New World, Columbus steered south by southwest in search of the gold of Cathay, but instead spotted a canoe on the open sea being paddled by a lone native. Pulling alongside the canoe in their giant ship, the European explorers saw that the canoe's cargo consisted of nothing but dried leaves. As the explorers were trying to make sense of this cargo, the paddler paused in his exertions to place a small wad of the dried leaves on a brazier of hot coals. He then placed a forked bone over the ensuing smoke to funnel it into his mouth, from whence he inhaled it deep into his lungs, held it for a long moment, and then let it out with a shout. The native then resumed his labors at the paddle, with a wordless glance over his shoulders at the giant ship from another world. Columbus did not find the gold he was seeking in Cathay, but he did find tobacco, and that tobacco became the gold of the New World. Today, tobacco is seen as a scourge of the planet and a killer of millions. But wait, is it the tobacco that is the killer, or is it something else? This thought leads us to ask, what do tobacco companies put in their cigarettes? And who better to ask than the author of Tobacco Culture, Mr. Bill Drake. Bill, welcome to the Food Chain.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be here. Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. So let's smoke out an answer or two here with you. So you lost your mother and father to cigarettes, right?
Yeah, like millions of other people. My parents were the World War II generation, heavy smokers, heavy drinkers, and died way too early.
Died way too early. Now, did you ever peg their deaths to cigarettes when you were growing up?
not until many years later, Michael. I just accepted it as a natural thing that people who smoked and drank heavily had heart attacks or got strokes and died young. Just seemed natural.
It's just the way of things, and you never did peg it to. When did your awareness of this whole tobacco thing come to you?
Well, back in the 70s, I was living in New Mexico, and some friends of mine from one of the pueblos brought me an offering of some tobacco seeds that they had found in a grave of a person who they thought was probably a shaman, judging by what was in the grave, and these tobacco seeds were probably a couple of hundred years old, and they knew I enjoyed gardening. They knew I'd written the Cultivator's Handbook of Marijuana many years ago. And so they gave me the seeds, and I planted them, and they came up beautifully. And
these 200-year-old seeds just sprang to life, right?
Exactly. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that Native Americans considered them such a powerful spiritual force, is that they were able to survive over hundreds of years and still germinate and grow.
But then I began,
as I spoke to the tobacco that I harvested, I realized that this was nothing like the cigarettes that I had smoked for many years.
Let's light it up for us. What was the tobacco like? Because I'm sure, many in the audience have smoked cigarette. I used to smoke some couple decades ago.
Right.
As many of us have. But what was it like to smoke real tobacco?
Well, I think the first thing is that it's like that first cigarette you ever had. Your head spins a little bit, and you have to sit down.
Right.
and then you realize that the taste is completely different. The impact on your body is completely different. There's a kind of a warmth that spreads through you. I'm not trying to make it sound glamorous, and I want to start off by saying if a person doesn't smoke, I don't want them to start smoking just because of the attraction of something new and different. But,
right.
You know, if a person is a commercial cigarette smoker, there's a lot of things they need to know about what they're being sold by these cigarette companies.
Which, of course, is where we're headed today. But with respect to that plant that grew in your backyard, that describe the plant for us. What does it look like?
It's a beautiful plant. It's a species called Nicotiana rustica, and it's one of several dozen native varieties, native to North America. In fact, in California, there were about a dozen different types of tobacco that were grown and used by literally hundreds of Native American tribes and bands who lived there before the white man came.
Sure, and of course it was a great custom of the Plains Indians that you smoked together. It's how you, you know, initiated conversations, really.
Exactly right, and there is a phrase, walking the smoke path to the spirit world. Shamans used these very potent tobaccos to go into spiritual trances and communicate with the other side. And there were many, many reasons why Native Americans smoked it. Not all sacred, by the way.
Sure.
Many of the traditions that have come down through anthropology talk about how proud a person was if his tobacco was the strongest tobacco and, you know, could knock people on their butt better than anybody else's tobacco.
Just like cannabis these days, right?
Yeah, exactly right.
Exactly
right.
So then, was the tobacco plant native to the Americas, or was it something that was found throughout the world?
No, it was native to the Americas only.
Ah.
And when it was first brought back to Europe, there were two camps. One was that it was the devil's weed. Obviously, anything that altered consciousness
sure.
was considered to be the work of the devil. And then there were, of course, many, many people who enjoyed the experience and sought it out, and it became, as you pointed out, literally the source of, the primary source of wealth of the English colonies in the New World.
First cash crop, probably. I love your description of Columbus tootling along and in this big ship and running across a canoe filled with dried leaves and watching the canoeist, you know, take a wad of this and put it on this fire and toke it up going on with his exertions, you know, with a scant look over his shoulder at this monster ship from another world. I love that description. But really, that was kind of what it must have been like.
Yeah, if you can put yourself in the world view and the mindset of that Indian man in the middle of the ocean running across this strange ship full of strange people. He apparently, according to the journals of the people on board that first ship, didn't pay much attention to him. He glanced up at him and then went back to his work. I mean, rowing a fully loaded canoe between the islands in the Caribbean was obviously very, very hard work, and being able to take a hit of good strong tobacco restored your energy and you know, set you off on the next stage of your journey.
And thus it was a canoe laden heavily with tobacco leaves indicates trade, right?
Precisely. It was it was one of the principal currencies between islands in the Caribbean as well as all across North America. It was not only an item of trade, but it was considered a sacred gift of the Great Spirit. You know, the Great Spirit gave four great gifts to his people: corn, beans, squash, and tobacco. And those four different kinds of foods, tobacco was considered a food for the soul, were at the core of not only spirituality, but trade.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about the role tobacco played in the culture of America and Europe as the two grew together and their oceans shrank in size and the customs of tobacco became ingrained in society and how there was, in fact, a number of tobacco prohibitions throughout history. So the one we are going through today, it's just another in a long line of them. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're looking into what tobacco companies put in cigarettes. What is it that kills people? Is it the tobacco, smoking the tobacco? Or is there something else in those cigarettes that's giving us such a hard time? What do you think? Love to hear from you. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking with Bill Drake, who's way down there in Texas, about tobacco culture. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, the smoking lamp is lit here on The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about cigarettes and tobacco with Bill Drake, author of Tobacco Culture, which is the Cultivator's Handbook of Natural Tobacco. And there is such a thing as natural tobacco because it was one of the crops endemic here to the Americas when European civilization bumped into our shores. They discovered the indigenous people partaking of this interesting plant and smoking it and using it in all kinds of ceremonies and took it back to Europe where it became really ingrained in the European culture, became a big cash crop for the Americas. But it wasn't always looked at with such favorable disposition by people of Europe. In fact, there are some very interesting accounts in the Tobacco Culture book about very famous people, kings and queens, looking askance at the smoking of tobacco in public places. Right, Bill Drake?
Oh, exactly. In fact, there was the death penalty for possession and smoking of tobacco in a number of countries over the course of the centuries.
In Turkey,
for
right?
For different reasons.
Yeah, in Turkey, right?
Yeah, in Turkey, it was the Suleiman the Great passed an edict that basically said, if you smoke, we're going to cut your head off in public.
I guess that would cure your habit right away.
Well, it certainly did cure some habits, but apparently didn't cure them all because anybody who's ever traveled in Turkey knows that the whole country is essentially covered with a cloud of smoke. Yeah. And not all tobacco smoke, I might add.
Right, right. Yeah. And, you know, up through the, I guess, Second World War, you know, cigarette smoking was just something almost everybody did. I don't know if you were a non-smoker in that period of time, what the heck you would have done. But, you know, throughout, for example, when I was in the Navy, you could smoke cigarettes almost everywhere, even though you're living on a floating bomb filled with enough, you know, explosive to blow you to the moon. They still had smoking, you know, you could still smoke cigarettes. And that's all changing, of course, but when did things start changing for us?
Well, you pinpointed it, actually. Up until the late 1930s, early 1940s, for one thing, tobacco products like cigarettes and so forth were actually tobacco.
Wait a minute. Say that one more time.
Well, up until the World War II, approximately, every cigarette made in America was made from real tobacco leaf, grown by tobacco farmers and harvested largely by hand.
And this would presume you're going to tell us that tobacco or cigarettes are no longer... Well, before we get there, so right after during World War II, things kind of started to change. And what was the change that brought this about?
Well, the biggest change was the introduction of pesticides. DDT was the first pesticide introduced to agriculture. And because tobacco is such a valuable crop, it worth more per acre than any other crop at the time.
Why was that? Why was it so valuable?
Because people were willing to pay for a relatively large amount of money for a relatively small amount of tobacco.
Could you not grow tobacco in your backyard as you did?
Absolutely, you certainly could, but people at the time, this is way before the Internet, of course, and the information didn't travel as easily then, and so most people were perfectly content to let the skilled folks in Virginia and North Carolina and Kentucky who had been growing tobacco for generations, grow that tobacco, and they were perfectly happy to have the cigarette companies package it up in convenient little tubes and sell it to them.
Yeah, that's to say that nobody here in California was growing it when they saw those Virginia people making all that money?
Actually, no. There was commercial tobacco grown in a number of different states, including California, but it never reached commercial scale. One of the things that I think your listeners need to know is that it's dead simple to grow your own tobacco. And if you are a smoker, on my website, which is cultivatorshandbook.com, I've got a very simple little set of instructions for how you can do it. And, of course, I've written a book for people who want to go into a little more depth. But
sure.
People who are being made victims by the cigarette companies these days need to understand exactly how they're being victimized, and then they need to understand how easy it is for them to stop feeding the beast.
And that's, of course, where you want to go today, but back at the end of the World War II, essentially tobacco was grown in the South, and that's where it was grown. It wasn't growing any other place, or at least it wasn't commercially grown in any other place.
Right. And that's when you start looking at the mortality figures for smoking, that's when the curve begins its rather steep ascent.
So what you're saying then is before the end of World War II, or before they started using pesticides, the mortality rate for cigarette smokers or smokers was not all that great.
Precisely, and there have been various attempts to say, well, records weren't being kept and so forth and so on, but that's really not true when you look at the research. The fact is that relatively few people who smoked in those days came down with what we now call the smoking-related diseases, lung cancer, stroke, emphysema, and so forth. Mm-hmm. All of the smoking-related diseases and death began escalating parallel with the use of pesticides. And pesticides, I know everybody, uses bug spray and so forth, and so a lot of people say, well, what's the big deal with pesticides? And it's actually an enormously complex story.
But first start us off with the notion that, tobacco plants produce nicotine, which is a natural pesticide, so why would they need to pesticides on tobacco?
Well, because nicotine is actually not the demon that many would have you think. One of the things that I discovered very quickly is that insects love tobacco plants. Bugs love tobacco plants because they're extremely rich in proteins and sugars.
Oh.
And particularly in tropical areas where there are a lot of bugs who have to compete for food sources, tobacco is one of the prime gourmet meals for leaf-eating bugs. So
if you want to grow tobacco and make a lot of money, then you have to figure out how to protect your plants.
Yes, and the way that this was done traditionally was that people grew tobacco on fairly small acreage and actually hand-tended their plants. They would walk through the rows of right. tobacco plants and pick off the tobacco hawk worms, and they would crush the nematodes underfoot. And, you know, they would turn their turkeys loose in their tobacco patch. The turkeys were loved to hunt down bugs.
Yeah.
They didn't turn chickens loose because chickens will scratch things up and kill your plants, but turkeys do a good job.
Huh. So it's essentially, before the advent of pesticides, then it was a small growers, a lot of small growers who were doing this. And then after World War II, with the development of the chemicals that derived from World War II, they were able to develop pesticides.
Exactly.
Industrialize agriculture and make a great big, huge farms out of it.
Exactly. And, of course, most of the a lot of the early pesticides were derived from nerve gas research that the Nazis did. And that we did also. So the first generation of pesticides, the pesticides that were used throughout the 40s and the early 50s, were basically poisons. They acted by literally poisoning the bugs and killing them. But by the early 50s, insects had become largely resistant to the poisons. So a second generation of pesticides had to be developed that interrupted the reproductive ability of insects.
Okay, Bill, we're going to have to take a quick break. But I have a sneaking suspicion I know where this is going to take us. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking about tobacco and cigarettes and the difference between tobacco and cigarettes and what tobacco companies put in cigarettes to make them the scourge of humankind. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, what do you think the tobacco companies put in cigarettes? We're here to find out. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Bill Drake, author of Tobacco Culture, The Cultivator's Handbook of Natural Tobacco. Second-generation pesticides were designed to interrupt the insect's reproductive mechanisms. We're getting good, aren't we?
Yeah, well, that's only part of the story. I'll try to keep it real short here because I know that you also want to talk about what the cigarette manufacturers actually put in cigarettes.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So to just bring your listeners up to up to the current day, the pesticides that were designed to interrupt the insect's reproductive abilities worked for a while, and then they stopped working, resistance again. And so they had to develop a third generation of pesticides, which are the pesticides currently in greatest use on tobacco worldwide. And those pesticides are designed to produce non-viable offspring, is the scientific term. So when people start talking about the dangers of secondhand smoke, they tend to focus on, you're getting nicotine in secondhand smoke. Real problem with secondhand smoke is all of these, this chemical soup that is laid on tobacco, primarily tobacco now grown in the third world. Because
let's stop for just a minute.
Yes.
And talk about what kind of federal government rules govern what tobacco companies may or may not put in their tobacco.
Actually, there's relatively few regulations regarding pesticide residues in tobacco. The U.S. government puts acceptable limits on certain kinds of pesticides, and some pesticides, especially the early organochlorines, the DDTs and so forth, are banned for use in the U.S. But here's where it gets interesting. Most of the tobacco used in American cigarettes is no longer produced in America. Most American tobacco farmers are out of business. What tobacco is in American cigarettes is largely imported from the third world, where there are no regulations regarding pesticides on food crops or tobacco. So
literally, they can use DDT.
Literally, there is DDT being used worldwide. But there's a corollary point that I think your listeners will find interesting. A couple of years ago, R.J. Reynolds, one of the biggest manufacturers, went to court in North Carolina and They went to court because they use 70 million pounds of tobacco waste every year, which they make into what's called sheet tobacco. Anybody who's
Wait a minute.
Yep.
S-H-E-E-T.
You know those 4x8 sheets of composite board that you can buy at any hardware store?
Right.
That made out of wood chips? Well, that's exactly what they do. They take the sweepings, the stalks and the stems and the dust that are collected from the processing factories in the third world. They import it into the U.S., and they mix it together with a wide variety of things that we can talk about, and they roll it out in these sheets.
Right. Let's talk about it now that we're talking about it. What else would they put in the tobacco sheet?
Well, one of the...
S-H-E-E-T.
Yeah, that's... So people are smoking a lot of sheet these days. If you want to just do a little science experiment, real easy if you're a smoker, break open one of your cigarettes and take a look at those little curls that you think are tobacco leaf underneath a magnifying glass or even better, a microscope. And you'll see that it is not leaf material. It's actually powder that's kind of been glued together. So that's the basic material.
With what? Glued together with what?
Well, each manufacturer has its own proprietary
secret sauce, right?
Yeah, R.J. Reynolds uses a process they call the G7 process. I don't know what it is, but I suspect two of the G's are garbage and glue.
So what are the other things they put in the sheet?
Well, they are, for one thing, they're able to titrate the exact amount of nicotine so that they can produce low-tar nicotine cigarettes. So in other words, instead of using natural leaf, which is kind of hard to control, what they basically do is take all of the nicotine out of the materials and then put it back in measured quantities.
Right. But what are the materials, the other materials other than tobacco residue?
One of the main materials is recycled cellulose that they get from a variety of sources. One of the biggest investors in the tobacco industry for many years was Kimberly-Clark.
We're talking wood chips.
We're talking wood chips and paper mill waste, basically. So they take this stuff, and then they
put it in the sheet.
They put it into sheets, and they incorporate into it a wide variety of things. There's a class of chemicals that the industry uses called smoker satisfaction chemicals, and each brand has its own smoker satisfaction set of smoker satisfaction chemicals, and they're basically behavior modification chemicals. They're the reason why if you smoke Marlboro Lights and you run out and a friend offers you a Camel Light, well, you'll probably take it, but as soon as you can, you'll go get yourself another pack of Marlboro Lights, because your brain and your body has literally been trained to expect a certain set of these smoker satisfaction chemicals.
Do we know what they are? What any of these smoker satisfaction chemicals would be?
Yeah, you can do search on the U.S. Patent Office website, and you will find literally thousands of patents. I can direct people again to my website, cultivatorshandbook.com, and under the smoke and illusion heading, they'll find access to a lot of that research. It would take way too long here on your hour show to detail it.
So what you're saying is that cigarettes now are not made of tobacco because you can't really control the nicotine content of tobacco. So you make cigarettes out of tobacco sheet, which has tobacco residue, cellulose, anything else? Toilet paper? Stuff like that, you know. I mean,
use diapers. Let me give you one story real quick that I think everybody will find really amusing. The reason R.J. Reynolds went to court about the 70 million pounds of toxic waste is they wanted a tax credit for disposing of it in an environmentally sound way. They said, well, you know, we've previously been throwing this stuff in landfills, and now we're using it to make cigarettes, so we want a tax credit for disposing of it in an environmentally sound manner.
So instead of throwing it into the garbage, we roll it up in cigarettes and sell it.
That's right, and that's environmentally sound, and we want a tax credit for it.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about, tobacco and cigarettes and tobacco companies and what those companies put in cigarettes, which doesn't seem to be much of tobacco anymore, and how that correlates to us dying from smoking their tobacco cigarettes. This is a Food Chain, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Bill Drake with us today, who is the author of Tobacco Culture and You. Pick up your phones and join us if you wish, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. When we get back, low tar, low nicotine, and you right back. Well, goodness sakes, if we're no longer growing tobacco in the United States and putting it into cigarettes, what the heck are we putting in there? Lo and behold, we're using tobacco waste from Zambia or someplace. Where does it come from, Bill?
All over the world, really. India, Africa, South America, Asia. One of the things that a couple of years ago, bidis, you know, the clove cigarettes were extremely popular here
right.
in the U.S. And I'm sure lots of people in Asia really laughing about that, because bidis are traditionally made from cigarette butts that are gathered on the streets of of Indonesian India, and of course you can imagine what those streets are like. And then they, by little children generally, who bring these cigarette butts to a processing plant, and they strip away the filters and so forth, and these garbage-soaked cigarette butts are then made into cigarettes. But first, they're really heavily scented with clove, and of course clove is used to disguise the smell of corpses and so forth and so on. So it's there you go.
I'll be reminded of that next time I smell one of those clove cigarettes. Let's go to Rich. Welcome to the Food Chain. You talk with Bill Drake, author of Tobacco Culture.
Yeah, I had a number of interesting questions. I think first of all, I don't smoke. I smoked about 1 week of my whole life, so I don't have to worry about this. But what percentage in this cigarette itself, what percentage of that is tobacco then? And of that tobacco, what percentage of that is American tobacco? So, what are we really smoking? What are they really smoking?
Yeah, what is it that we're smoking when we smoke cigarettes?
Of course, this varies. It'll vary brand by brand, you know. And so giving you one number is not useful. But
if you were to give us an average,
I would say on average, the most commercial cigarettes contain less than 5% real tobacco leaf.
5%?
In other words, tobacco leaf is too expensive. From the manufacturer's point of view, as long as people are willing to smoke toxic waste, garbage, that's what they'll use because it's cheap. So the only way to really get, if you are a smoker, there's two ways to be able to smoke tobacco leaf. One is there's a company, Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company, which I had a role in starting, and they do produce organic tobacco, and it is real, and it is organic tobacco. And the second way, Michael, after reading your book, Metro Farm, it's something that I hope when you revise it, you'll add a chapter on tobacco, because growing your own is easy, it's simple, it can be done by anybody. You can grow it in a couple of 10-gallon pots on a balcony, you can grow it in a backyard, it's fun and it's easy to grow, and you know what you're smoking.
There you go. Rich?
What percentage of that 5% is American leaf tobacco?
Almost none, Rich, because what American tobacco is still being produced is sold to Europe, because European governments have very, very strong regulations on pesticide residues, and American tobacco is to some extent regulated with regard to the pesticides that can be used. So practically none is, with the exception, again, of Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company's products, practically no American tobacco at all.
All right, as a non-smoker, then, I'm picking up secondhand garbage is what I'm picking up in the smoke. Is that right?
Absolutely, you are. And it gets a little worse than that. For example, when these pesticides that are on this garbage are incinerated on the tip of the cigarette, they're not burned up. They're actually changed. A DDT, for example, when it's burned, turns into dioxin.
Which is even worse.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Let's go to Marshall. Marshall, welcome to the food chain. You're talking with Michael Olson and Bill Drake. Go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering, those natural spirits with an Indian logo on them, are those natural tobacco?
Yes. If they're made by Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company, they are 100% real tobacco, and it's American-grown tobacco for the most part, though they do... some of their organic tobaccos are, I believe, produced in Mexico. I'm not associated with the company anymore, haven't been for years, but they're the only commercial cigarette manufacturer that you can be sure their products actually are tobacco.
Okay, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
You know, I just turned the radio on and I heard that only 5% of the content of the, you know, what is supposedly tobacco is actually tobacco, an American ready-roll cigarette. Is that what I heard?
That's what you heard.
Okay.
But you missed the best part of it.
Yeah, well,
you missed the part
anymore,
about the sheet that they put into this tobacco.
The what?
The sheet. You'll have to pick up tobacco culture and learn all about tobacco sheet. That's S-H-E-E-T.
It's not credible. That's all.
Well, let me invite you to go onto my website.
I don't need to hear anymore. And when you bring a guest like this, that is so inflammatory.
Yes, you're inflammatory.
There's only one place in San Jose that he started that actually uses tobacco leaves. And, you know, having been into the South and to Winston-Salem, the town of Winston-Salem, they're using tobacco, trust me. I mean, this is
okay.
Crazy.
Let's ask Bill about that, Bill.
Well, your caller makes a good point. Tobacco is definitely still being grown to some extent in the South, but for the most part, that tobacco is going to Europe to be made into cigarettes in Europe, and for the most part, American cigarette manufacturers do not buy or use American-grown tobacco.
There you go, other Bill. We'll be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, there you go, folks. Bill Drake says there isn't much tobacco left in tobacco, and the other Bill calls and says, well, there must be. There has to be. It couldn't be, like you say, but can it, Bill? Is there tobacco in tobacco?
A little time doing the research can take a look at the import figures for tobacco. On the U.S. Department of Agriculture website, and you will see that literally millions of pounds of tobacco a year come in from around the world. And you'll see that substantial amount of American tobacco is exported principally to Europe, also to Japan. So really, the data is all there, and I can understand people saying, oh, I just don't believe it. How is it possible that a respectable industry that's regulated by our government would do such a thing? But, the government makes, the federal and state governments combined make about $125 million a day off of taxes on these cigarettes. So there's a lot of vested interest out there in keeping
$125 million dollars a day?
$125 million. If you've got 50 million smokers, it's about $2.50 a pack, federal and state taxes combined. If you got 50 million people each smoking a pack a day, the math is easy. That's $125 million a day. So
Bill Drake, author of Tobacco Culture, you have three things to remember. Number one, Surgeon General warnings. What about it?
Well, interesting, the Surgeon General warnings, if you read them carefully, and they're very carefully crafted, do not say tobacco. Not a single one of the warnings mention tobacco. They say smoking, they say this product, so forth and so on. They don't say tobacco. And so they've been carefully crafted basically to give the cigarette companies a pass, because they can say, well, look, this warning, you know, the warning on the label warns you, you were given fair notice, don't complain to us because you got lung cancer.
Okay, number two, only one of the pesticides used on tobacco has been tested.
I'm sorry, only one has been tested?
That's yes, that's one of the things and found to be a carcinogen.
Oh, well, carcinogenicity is only one mechanism of disease. Genetic breaks, there's interference with reproduction, there are any number of different ways that different pesticides act on the human system, neurologically, genetically, in terms of reproduction and so forth. So toxicity is only one issue.
Okay. And number three, none of the foreign tobacco, nor synthetic tobaccos, nor tobacco sheet has ever been tested for the impact on human health.
Well, that's correct in one sense. In another sense, the test cigarettes that are used to determine that are used in health impact testing are made actually from a standard Kentucky Virginia blend of tobacco. They don't pull cigarettes off the shelf of the 7-Eleven and test them. So they're standardized test cigarettes.
So
they
thing,
don't really have much to do with what people on the street are smoking.
So if you want to smoke, the thing to do is to get some tobacco seeds, plant them on 10-gallon pots or out in your deck, and roll your own, and you might survive. Is that a fair summation, Bill Drake?
That's a fair summation, with one additional point in that it is a beautiful plant. It's fun to grow. It's easy to grow. And if people want a complete free guide to how to do it, they can log on to my website, cultivatorshandbook.com, and on the order page, there's a link to a complete detail
there
on how
go.
To do it.
Out of time. Thank you, Bill Drake. Appreciate it. Bye-bye,
Thank
everyone.
You, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.